Kevin Clements, the director of the Toyota Peace Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Olivia Stokes-Dreyer, who heads up our Global Challenges to Democracy program. Together, we're facilitating this public conversation on current challenges to democracy, and in particular, challenges to democracy in America, with Professors Stefan Haggard and Bob Kaufman. We couldn't have asked for two better experts on the subject than these two scholars. Their last jointly authored book was Backsliding, Democratic Regress in the Contemporary World. We'll refer to that book in this conversation, but our primary focus is going to be on what's happening to democracy in America under the second Trump administration. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Olivia, Stefan, and Bob. And the first question I want to ask you both is, please share in brief what led you to write your 2021 book on what's changed in the global picture in relation to democratic erosion between the book's publication and Trump's inauguration.
I think that the main motivation of writing the first book was the first Trump administration alarm over the first over what was going on in the United States. That also provoked questions about backsliding that was going on in other parts of the world. So I think that was an important source of our concerns.
Yeah, I'll just make a comparative observation. We spent a long time in our careers talking about transitions to and from democratic rule. And if we look at the long sweep of post-war history, most regressions to authoritarian rule came through the coup. So militaries would intervene. But backsliding, where duly elected officials, that is fairly elected officials, undertook actions once in office to limit the scope of democracy, that was a relatively new phenomena. And while I think Bob is right that this was triggered in part by the Trump administration, it was also triggered by what was happening in Hungary and Poland and El Salvador and some of the the Latin American Andean countries, Bolivia, Venezuela, obviously. And so I think those cases were also very much on our mind.
Good. So moving now to what's happening in the U.S., in your 2021 book, you describe backsliding as set in motion by polarization, the rise of illiberal candidates, and legislative acquiescence in the collapse of separation of powers. So where do you see the U.S. currently along that trajectory?
Well, I mean, sadly, I'll start this time. I think that the type of things we said pretty much hold, with one possible interesting exception. So clearly, the executive is overreaching. I think our findings with respect to legislative acquiescence could not have proven more true, because the Republican Party has effectively abdicated any of its oversight responsibility in trying to rein in the president. But I think one thing we didn't see is that past patterns of backsliding that we identified, rulers kind of picked away at the rule of law, by which I mean they took a relatively incremental approach to expanding their power and weakening various forms of constraints. And Trump is just flooding the zone. That expression is used a lot here. It's just extraordinarily difficult to keep up with the pace of executive orders and unilateral actions that the executive has taken. And I think that also makes it difficult for the opposition to respond, because there's so many things to respond to. I'll just cite one example. There are currently over 100 legal cases, suits that have been filed against the administration for some aspect of its policy choices. And that's ticking every day. I mean, there are new cases being brought, every day. And so I think that gives you some sense of the scope of executive actions which are causing alarm.
Okay, so maybe that's the lead on to the next question there, which is, are you really surprised by the pace of backsliding? And what And what do you really attribute that accelerated pace to? It seems to me that one of the things which she has had to do is kind of declare these kind of crazy states of emergency to justify the executive orders. Is this just enabling him to be autocratic on speed?
Let me backtrack just a minute, Kevin, in terms of the earlier question about what is new in the landscape. And it segues into the issues that you just raised. I think that the biggest thing that's new is the return of Donald Trump to the presidency after a period of time when we thought he was finished. And as you're suggesting, he's not only come back into the presidency, but he's come back in a much more dangerous and sort of ferocious attack on the American democratic system. And has taken most of us somewhat by surprise in terms of how rapidly he's undermined so many pillars of, or started over undermine so many pillars of American democracy. I think the big change, Steph alluded to it, was the capture of the American Congress by a very disciplined and obedient and autocratic Republican Party. And this is, as in other backsliding cases that we examine, this has really opened the way to a real onslaught on the rest of the American government, as well as on civil society and other parts of the American political system. So I think the sort of the return of Trump, the ferocity with which he's attacked and he and his people have attacked American institutions is, has implications not only for the United States and democracy in our country, but also obviously, given the United States position, implications for the rest of the world. So I think there is a real shift in the kind of not only the domestic political landscape, but the international political landscape.
Yeah, apart from the pace, which has been dramatic, I'm curious what else has surprised you. I mean, many say, oh, actually, this was all in Project 2025, had we taken it seriously. But how much of this would you have predicted or did predict, and how much has surprised you?
Well, look, I would say that the totality of it has surprised all of us. I mean, if you just look at the number of executive orders, but also I think Bob is hinting at something, which I agree with. It's the principles which are under attack. So, let's take a case like this case that your listeners might know about, the return of Abrego Garcia from his disappearance, actually, or abduction. I think you have to start calling things by their real names, into the El Salvador gulag. I mean, this is an attack on due process. And increasingly, that's the way it's being portrayed in the American public. And one interesting check that's emerging is that case, which you would think would be on winning territory for the president because it appears to be an immigration case, is stirring a fair amount of concern across the political spectrum because of the fact that it appears to be a due process case. Because charges are being made about this individual's gang history. First of all, he's here legally. He was in the United States legally for reasons I can explain. They're not straightforward. But he was essentially accused of being a gang member and was deported for that reason without appearing in court or having that proposition tested in any way. And there are reasonable reasons to think that that characterization was false, including the fact that he himself had applied for asylum in the United States precisely because of his concern about violence that were perpetrated by gangs against him in his home country. So I think that, you know, what's most disturbing is the kind of core principles which are under attack.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk about the independence of the judiciary, the independence of law firms, the independence of the universities. You know, we can go down the list, but it's the significance of the principles which are under attack that I think has caused the most alarm.
Do you have any comments on that, Bob?
Just a quick footnote on this issue. I think that related to that is the fact that there's so much uncertainty about when and if Trump will accept rulings from the courts. He has, you know, clearly in the case of that Steph was talking about, he has not, including accepted a ruling from the Supreme Court. In other cases, the behavior is more ambiguous. And the question is, he's received a lot of pushback from the courts, from the lower courts especially. And I think it's still an open question as to whether he is going to respect those decisions.
There's been a big debate as to when the overreach of the Trump administration would really trigger a constitutional crisis. I mean, how near are we to that now? I mean, what's your view on you know, how this might suddenly be challenged kind of systematically? I'm really appreciative of all of the thousands of protests that are going on across America all the time at the moment. But does that reflect the constitutional crisis, or does there have to be something else that will kind of enable this sort of crisis that, you know, he's responsible for and should be dealt with?
Or when it happens that he just absolutely doesn't obey the orders of the Supreme Court. I mean, is that when we get there, or are we already there with the other things you're speaking to?
Oh, we're there. I mean, in my humble opinion, I mean, we really are there. This is not something which lies in the future. But the reasons for that are somewhat complicated. I mean, because it isn't necessarily simply refusing to abide by a court ruling. It's the way that he's playing with ambiguities in language to stretch out the process in order to avoid actually complying with decisions. So there's that side of things. But the other issue, which is not going to be resolved until these court cases come to a head, is that it appears, at least to some of us, that claims of executive power of various sorts that he's claiming that are in the executive orders will almost certainly subsequently be found to be illegal. And so he's operating under this advantage of shock and awe of making claims about executive power, which just seem on their face to exceed his authority and are almost certainly likely to be found as such, but that's not stopping him from doing it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that the definition of a constitutional crisis is unclear, at least to me. I don't know. I can't really respond to that, but it's clear. What is clear, as Steph has just laid out, is that Trump is pushing the limits, and he's pushing the limits, constitutional limits, very, very hard. Earlier, we talked about the accelerated pace of the changes that he's instituted in comparison with the first Trump administration. I think that's true. But I also think that the exploitation of ambiguity in the law, the gray areas of the law, which were characteristic of the first Trump administration, continue to be characteristic of what we're seeing now. And, you know, the fact that there could be some kind of debate about whether Trump is actually defying the courts is itself a kind of indication of the ambiguity and the ability of Trump to exploit that ambiguity.
Unfortunately, you sort of have to play this out in individual cases to see the nature of the controversy. So let me go back to Abrego Garcia. I mean, he's a, you know, this is an example, but there are others, but it's one that, you know, I've talked about. So I'll return to it. So following a set of appeals, the Supreme Court came to the decision that the administration had to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia to the United States after a lower court had said that the administration had to facilitate and effect his return. Now, it defies belief that a president who had contracted with the president of El Salvador to take these detainees is unable to reverse that decision, particularly given the power asymmetry between the two countries. I mean, it just defies reason, right? And so that's why I say the constitutional crisis is here, because it's very clear that he could facilitate Abrego Garcia's return, but he said, I'm not going to do that, because if he were brought back, he would simply be deported again. I mean, that comes as close to outright defiance of a judicial ruling as can be imagined. And to say that there's ambiguity there and so forth is itself to confuse the question, and in some ways to play into the hands of the administration with respect to what he's doing. And I just want to emphasize that this can be repeated.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, I think it's highly unlikely that the courts will uphold the proposition that the administration is within its writ to tell universities how they admit students, their curriculum, what courses can be taught, whether the word diversity or gender, whatever, can be used in the universities. I mean, it's just highly unlikely that that will be sustained. But that hasn't stopped the administration from engaging in essentially attacks on the university using the cudgel of resources that the federal government controls, which, by the way, were appropriated by Congress for the purposes that they're being used in the universities.
Right. So in a way, Steph, what you're pointing to, and Bob as well, feels like a vulnerability in our system that he's doing a very good job of exploiting, in that these court cases can drag on and drag on, and he can keep repeating and using the ambiguity of language. Is there anything in our democracy that gives recourse when that's happening?
Notice the stunned silence. Bob, you go ahead. I'll jump in.
This is a retrospective point that is not really an answer to your question. But I often think, I often compare the treatment of Trump after his first presidency with the treatment of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil when he was defeated for re-election. And there's a key difference. The judicial system very quickly began to prosecute Bolsonaro. And within, I don't know the exact time frame, but within a very short period of time, they ruled that he could not run for re-election. What we know in the Trump case is that he was able to exploit the pace of the judicial system, delay, obscure, until it was too late, really, to punish him. And I think that, you know, the American judicial system is set up in a particular way, layers of judgments, appeals, reappeals. That it's a very slow moving process, and it's simply not well adapted to deal with the kinds of emergency situations that we, whether it's a crisis or not, we can debate, but the emergency situation that we're looking at.
Do you think that that Trump feels that he has immunity and impunity from prosecution because of the Supreme Court ruling that a sitting president shall not face prosecutions for things done in the course of his presidency? Was that where this all started?
That where it started.
That's certainly a piece of it. Certainly a piece of it. Bob,
go ahead. A big boost, I think, for Trump. I mean, yes. I mean, it's ominous. It's a terrible decision. And for a court that values supposedly original intent, it's a startling kind of extension of a constitutional extension of presidential powers.
I mean, whether the proposition will ever be tested, I mean, there are certainly activities that he's currently engaged in. And this is a story that maybe listeners haven't been paying as much attention to, which is the issue of corruption around things like the issuing of meme coins and crypto policy and so forth, where they're just, you know, the conflicts of interest are legion. But I think with respect to the, you're asking sort of several questions. The first is where, what does the judiciary have in its toolkit that could actually bring the government to heel beyond reputational concerns? And I think that one thing that's coming up as we speak are decisions about whether parties should be held in contempt of the court. And so for the judiciary to actually take the step of saying that, you know, XYZ official is in contempt for failing to abide by court rulings. But the other piece of your question is broader, because it's about the other types of checks that might operate on the president to get him to reverse course. And of course, the ultimate one is electoral. Because at some point in the future, Trump is going to have to face the American electorate. And what we're seeing is a fairly significant decline in positive approval ratings. So that could at some point re-engage Congress to bring up issues that they think are causing political damage for the president. But you know, those things also are, you know, have so far proven slow moving. And they've taken the form of really almost like rent-seeking behavior, you know, please relieve my district from, you know, tariff X, you know, that kind of thing. And they're not addressed to the larger systemic issues of whether he has the authority to impose these tariffs in the first place, which, by the way, the Republican Party voted that he did have the authority to do that, partly so that they wouldn't have to deal with it.
Right. I mean, we do want to get to what you think can be done to defend U.S. democracy. But maybe before we do, what at this stage concerns you the most? I mean, if this gets worse, what do you most fear? I mean, what, you know, it's...
Well, I, you know, taking up a point that Steph has already raised, you know, he's already ignored some court rulings. But I think that if this the pace of defiance of the courts accelerates, you know, let me back up. A lot of presidents have kind of challenged the court's authority at various points. I think what matters in Trump's case is that it's systematic and comprehensive. And so if we see a kind of an accumulation of acts of defiance of explicit court rulings, I think that we're in serious trouble. The second, I think, sign of serious trouble, that we're already seeing some of that, this goes to Steph's point about the electorate, is efforts at the state level to rig voting rights and rig, you know, the voting count process. I mean, we haven't really talked about that yet, but this is an extraordinarily serious question that's still up in the air, still isn't fully resolved. And then the final point I would make is, and we, you know, we haven't really touched this either, is the role of political violence. The question of whether, I mean, that right now we're already seeing threats and acts of violence, scattered acts of violence. You know, one question that I have in my mind is that whether, as the election gets close, as the congressional election gets closer, or as the next presidential election gets closer, whether we're going to see a kind of a resurgence of, you know, Proud Boy type activities. And this would raise, I think, the danger to a very new level.
Yeah, I mean, the incitement to violence is connected. All of these things are connected in very complex ways to the way in which the executive is or is not constrained. And, you know, studies of the executive after the first Trump administration pointed out the perversities of the pardon power. Because effectively, if you can pardon people who engage in what is in effect political violence, then you incite that political violence because the people who are perpetrating it are know that the president is going to get them off the hook. And I just think I can't communicate the shock, including among law enforcement, of the fact that the pardons for the January 6th insurrection were blanket in nature. They weren't targeted to a handful of people who happened to be wandering through the rotunda thinking it was a tourist, you know, gathering. But essentially extended to everyone. And the same is true, by the way, of corruption. The pardons so far have included people who have been engaged in just outright corruption. And apparently, I haven't followed the individual cases, but some of the people who are pardoned are already back in front of police and legal authorities for breaking the law. Which indicates that they were wrongly pardoned because there's clearly very little contrition and they're repeat offenders. You've got recidivism, right?
What do you both think about the weaponization of justice? I mean, the fact that, you know, the Attorney General seems disinclined to do anything that will be critical of Trump, the head of the FBI in the same and his deputy is the same. When you're confronted with an institution now that is only willing to do Trump's bidding, what are the prospects for the rule of law?
Everything you said, Steph, earlier, just now, is part of a authoritarian playbook that we see in, you know, lots of other countries, in Hungary and Turkey, you know, in Venezuela, in a variety of authoritarian, of backsliding countries that have gone all the way into authoritarianism. What does this imply? Well, above and maybe most importantly, the perversion of the rule of law, what some people call lawfare, which means that you use the legal structures to reward your friends and cronies and punish your enemies. And I think that this is what we're seeing. I mean, this is very much a part of an overall comparative pattern that we're now seeing in the United States.
And let me just make a comment on some other cases, again, that your listeners may or may not be aware of. But one of the more interesting cases, which was recently resolved, we'll see if it goes all the way to the Supreme Court, has to do with a law firm named Perkins Coie. And Perkins Coie and several other law firms had partners who, either on a pro bono basis or on the basis of cases that they took up from clients, found itself in court against the first Trump administration on a number of occasions. And Trump literally issued an executive order that didn't point out law firms in general, but pointed out Perkins Coie as posing risk and called on the Justice Department to investigate whether this firm should be excluded from being able to represent its clients in court against the administration. And the courts have found that executive order was unconstitutional. And so, you know, what I'm trying to communicate is the myriad ways, we haven't even talked about the universities yet, but the myriad ways in which, you know, these institutions, fundamental institutions and rule of law are under attack. It's just hard to convey the scope of it.
Yeah.
Let me just bring up one other, because it also gets at one of the issues of what constitutes a liberal democracy as opposed to electoral democracy. And again, you know, if you don't know the American system, this might, you know, come as somewhat of a surprise, but the executive oversees both what we call departments, you call ministries, over which the president has a certain amount of authority to dictate what those ministries and departments do. But it also houses a large number of independent agencies which are established by congressional authority in order to manage complex regulatory issues, whether it's consumer financial protection or transportation health and safety and so on. And by statute, these bodies are not supposed to are not supposed to be staffed at the president's discretion. They're supposed to be staffed on ways that retain their independence. Well, he's been firing people from these agencies, you know, removing horizontal checks on his authority. So the conversation in the United States about sort of the theory of the case is really deepening, because, you know, there are people who thought that President Trump was doing on coming to office was essentially he had a substantive agenda of things that he wanted to do, and, you know, he's doing them. But I think increasingly the theory of the case is that President Trump is trying to maximize his discretion on virtually every imaginable front, and then to exploit that discretion to advance the interests of his supporters and to go after, you know, potential opponents in a whole variety of ways, legal, financial, through the press, and so on. And that's why this is particularly concerning. It's not just a question of policy disagreements. It's about a president who is really trying to maximize his discretion in order to pursue an agenda which it appears increasingly to me to be personal in nature.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of this whole issue of what's in his supporters' interests, I mean, surely it's not in their interest to get rid of federal aviation authorities and air traffic controllers and have the Newark airport kind of listed as unsafe for travel. You know, and in relation to health issues, I mean, I have a colleague at Auckland University who's been working with 26 other countries on vaccine efficacy and so forth, and they've just had their entire budget cancelled before they can write the final report. I mean, how are these things in the interests of his supporters?
Well, we'll see. I mean, one of the interesting factoids I like to cite is, you know, take a deep red state like Alabama. The largest employer in the state is the University of Alabama. And you know, the senator from that state has been saying, oh, wait, you know, what's going on here? You know, as this institution is being subtly gutted. So, but then the question is, how long does it take for that feedback loop to operate? And this raises a somewhat different question. And Bob and I were talking briefly about this morning in anticipation of our conversation, which is that the challenge of democracy is often posed in terms of the discretion of the executive, the integrity of the judiciary, the separation of powers, allowing Congress to do what it's supposed to do and making sure that the branches, not just the judiciary and the executive, but also Congress and the executive, are sort of squared away. But there's also this alarming thing that's going on, which is the destruction of state capacity, which is not usually something that we would attach to democracy per se, but in fact is quite central to it. Because if the government is to do things, it has to have the capacity to do things. And the USAID case was, you know, just clearly a targeted piece of low-lying fruit because Americans don't like foreign aid. But that's now being replicated across the departments in areas where citizenry does have an interest in there being this kind of regulatory capability. And so, you know, when you talk about the assault on democracy, it's not just those traditional things you learn in your civics book. It's this deeper issue of whether the administrative capacity for the government to do things is being gutted, and whether the purposes behind that are really have to do with policy, or whether they're ideological, or whether they're just an effort to restructure the civil service in such a way that people who work in the executive branch are essentially loyal to the president.
It's clearly impacting them. You know, Steph mentioned the University of Alabama. A broader issue is Medicaid, you know, and with the question of whether, you know, proposed cuts in Medicaid, you know, how that will fly. I think the question that I have, and I don't think it's yet answered, the question of whether we are, our society is so polarized politically that Trump, you know, will, the question of how blame is assigned is crucial here. Whose fault is it? Well, we know that, of course, it's Trump and his supporters. It's their fault. But that's not self-evident to large segments of the American population, especially with the media environment being what it is. And so, sure, there's going to be public backlash. There already is some public backlash. But how that's going to play out politically, I think it's still quite unclear.
I mean, as Steph is pointing out, and you are as well, I mean, his poll numbers are dropping dramatically across a number of different issues. So clearly there is a large part of the population that is seeing the impact of these various agencies being gutted and a lot of concern. I think the question of how much Trump cares is a question. And, you know, he did a very good job of rallying his support and supporters and acting as though he cares. But ultimately, to whom is he really beholden? And, you know, to what extent are we also becoming a bit of a kleptocracy, you know, in terms of the corruption, et cetera? You know, how much is ideological for him, or how much is just transactional? I mean, there's so many questions involved here. But yeah.
Well, let me jump in on one thing because the conversation here in the United States has centered to a surprising extent over the last 3 weeks, since April 2nd, to be precise, on tariff policy.
Right.
Interestingly, I mean, we don't forget that, you know, because in some ways, the most significant and wide-ranging policy experiment that the Trump administration has engaged in is with respect to U.S. trade policy. And there, you know, it's just interesting to note that the constraints on the president are not just those that operate through institutions or through political coalitions, but they also operate through the market. And a very interesting thing happened, which is following the tariff announcement, which was just a complete shock in terms of how wide-ranging it was, the president also made comments about the independence of the Federal Reserve. And there was this very brief period, about 2 or 3 days following April 2nd, when there were these very large jumps in the yields on 10-year treasuries. That is, the bonds were selling off because price moves in the opposite direction of yield. And that appeared to really jolt the administration because, you know, the United States relies very heavily both on its own citizens and the rest of the world to finance its, you know, incredible appetite for debt. And if that market were to really unravel, then the president would be experiencing a hell of a lot more effective check on what he's doing than you see from any of the other angles we're talking about. And I suspect there's a broader issue there too, which is, you know, the tariffs are just have this very wide ranging and yet unpredictable effect. And I think that's part of what's costing him now, because the effects are starting, you know, over the next several weeks are going to start to be felt. People who are nerdy are watching, you know, shipping traffic through the major West Coast ports. And that's not something, that's something you can actually predict out several weeks, because, you know whether ships are going to be docking, unloading or not, and whether they're carrying cargo, and they're not. You know, it's quite dramatic. And all of those shipping containers, many of them at least, are attached not only to consumers, but to small businesses that essentially manufacture offshore through these, you know, supply chains, who are now standing up, you know, and saying, look, you know, I'm out of inventory, you know, I'm going under. And those stories are proliferating. And I think the markets and the economy will also probably act as a check, at least on some things that the president is doing.
Could we go back a little bit and say, well, what is the reason for this assault on the universities, apart from envy and discontent with, you know, the elite chattering classes of the academy? I mean, it's sort of just kind of shocking here the way in which that the independence of the academy has been assaulted. I mean, so what was the justification for this? I mean, you know, we have New Zealand academics now not canceling out of conferences based in the US because they just don't want to put themselves in a position of jeopardy. I mean, it's having all kinds of repercussions.
Kevin, in many respects, all established institutions are under attack. It's not only the universities, it's, you know, the legal profession, the medical profession, you know, it's the press, you know, across the board. I think the driving force behind all of that, and specifically about the driving force behind the university, is the MAGA movement, which is very anti-elite, and which views the university, particularly the high prestige universities, the Ivies and so forth, as a bastion of the elite. Now that view is not necessarily shared by all parts of the Trump coalition. I think there's a corporate elite and business elite that doesn't necessarily share those views. But people like J.D. Vance, even though he was a Yale graduate, these are the class enemies, and they represent the class enemies. And so while Trump himself, I think he's utterly transactional. I don't think he has any ideological principles. I'm not even sure he's all that committed to tariffs, even though people think he is. Certainly not necessarily committed to these kinds of intellectual onslaughts. But I think the core followers are. Mm-hmm. And that for them, not necessarily for Trump, but for them, this is ideological. Mm-hmm. You know, the universities represent the enemy. I think that's part of the reason why there's so much venom associated with these attacks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it's fair to say that the American top American research universities, and certainly in the social sciences, I would say, and the humanities are dominated by liberals. I don't think there's any question about that. They were at the forefront of pursuing the objectives of diversion, equity, and inclusion, in a good way, in my view. But there's another way to look at the attack on the universities, which is emblematic of a somewhat different take on the presidency, which is just the failure to understand how existing institutions work, and the belief in the motto, you know, break things and get things done. So I don't think this is fully appreciated, but, you know, there are two pieces to the university question. There's the Harvard-Columbia issue of trying to get these institutions, bring these institutions to heel with respect to DEI, anti-Semitism, protests on campus, and so forth. And that there's a whole set of questions that have crystallized around that, which have to do with free speech. And, you know, I think some of that overreach will ultimately be pared back on free speech grounds. But there's also this effort to claw back the way that North American institutions, American institutions of higher learning are financed, which is through government grants that have allocated in them quite substantial overhead. And in the name of finding fiscal savings, the administration has forced universities to accept a much lower overhead numbers, even though that's been part of a compact which has allowed the universities to grow and function in the role that they have over the last, you know, the entire post-war period, effectively.
Yeah.
And I personally think that almost as much damage is being done, if not more, to the universities from the failure to understand the way that they're funded. And this is on the science side. This doesn't, you know, the social sciences are just, and the humanities are just a drop in this bucket, as it is about the ideological things that animate what I would call the J.D. Vance wing of the Republican Party.
Yeah. I'm thinking we probably should be moving on to what can be done to defend democracy in the U.S. I mean, Steph, you suggested that what will happen with the tariffs and the impact, economic impacts may in of themselves act as a bit of a check at some point. The court cases will take a long, long time. Who knows what will happen with the midterms? But what in your minds, I mean, protests are happening. What in your minds are effective means of addressing the situation? Stop the bleeding.
One thing that's just really exciting and interesting that's going on in the United States right now is the discussion within the Democratic Party about how it should deal with this and what lines of attack, how to position oneself, how to position the party in terms of what's going on. And there, I say it's exciting because there's real thought going into this, you know. I think one thing we've learned is that the democracy trope, the idea that you can rally people around the democracy theme was exaggerated. And so then the question is, okay, so if that doesn't work, what is the line of attack on the administration? And I think there are, you know, two somewhat different wings of the Democratic Party that pull in different directions. One is the anti-monopoly wing, which basically sees the Trump administration as a corrupt plutocracy that's backed by an oligarchy. And that's Bernie Sanders and AOC. And that's sort of the message there. They're pressing, you know, under every rock there's, you know, corporate greed in effect, but just corporate power. And another wing of the party that's trying to think about how to take up some of the lessons from this debacle and figure out how to position the Democratic Party with a more positive pro-growth image. And I would associate this with people like Ezra Klein and his new book, Abundance, where he's saying, look, you know, the Democrats have to come up with a way to get things done, you know, build housing, build high-speed rail, get rid of NIMBY, you know, move forward and put a positive vision in front of the American public that will, you know, not swing all of the Trump electorate, that's impossible, but just swing enough voters back so that the system would kind of recalibrate.
Could we focus a little bit of attention as well on foreign policy? I mean, I'm sitting in New Zealand and we have got both the direct and indirect consequences of this. I mean, you know, what was the kind of, you know, rationale for tariffs when it's just generated such chaos? you know, what, you know, to what extent does Trump really believe that, you know, we're about to annex Greenland and you know, and yesterday in his humiliating kind of conversation with the Canadian Prime Minister, I mean, and the Panama Canal and everything else. I mean, you know, all of these things just kind of generate a sort of a widespread feeling of instability outside of America. We're seeing the international rules-based system go down the gurgler, and we're rushing to kind of, you know, figure out ways in which it can be salvaged. China is trying to present itself as the, you know, the major promoter of a rules-based order. I mean, what, how do you explain, you know, the absurd kinds of foreign policy positions, and worse, the deliberate humiliation of prime ministers and others. I mean, the Zelensky Oval Office occasion was one, but I mean, he, you know, Trump now uses each of these Oval Office events as an opportunity to humiliate. I mean, we had an article here the other day about, you know, Trump's one of the Trump's effects is to kind of kill kindness and compassionate politics all around the world. I mean, so how do you explain this? I mean, and why, and you know, how does it play out in the US? It must be, there must be people who think this is just crazy and Article 25 should be invoked.
Well, look, I want Bob to answer this, but I just want to make one observation from your neck of the woods. Look what happened in the Australian election.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, let's not forget that this is, you know, there's clearly a Trump effect, which does not move in the direction of strengthening alliances with the type of people he wants to strengthen alliances with. I mean, everyone here who watched that, they're just slack-jawed. I mean, the outcome of that election is just staggering. There hasn't been anything in 50 years in Australia that approaches that kind of margin.
That's right.
And then, you know, the woman who ousted Dutton from his own district, I mean, you know, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. No, that was, and the Canadian election was pretty similar. I mean, it's astonishing. Yeah. Conservative party lost out, you know.
I think the Australia one actually trumps it, but the, absolutely Canada also. Yeah, you have a go at this one.
A broader answer to your question or response to your question. I mean, I think that this is of a piece, Trump's behavior with his behavior in the whole other areas of his life. I mean, if you look at his career in real estate, it was the same kind of thing, you know, bullying, betraying allies, using power when he could. I think this is what's going on domestically in terms of the kind of crony capitalism that is emerging. And I think the same thing is true internationally, that the policy is based, the idea of a rules-based order is not within the framework of the Trump administration. It's all about power. And so that means alliance with, powerful. Of course, he likes dictators better than Democrats. I mean, they're the ones who are powerful. Of course, he prefers Putin to Zelensky because this is consistent with the kind of worldview and the general approach that he has. So the question is, and I think we already know the answer, unfortunately, is whether any of this can be, any of the rules-based order can be reconstituted in the aftermath of Trump. And I really think the egg has been, you know, Humpty Dumpty has been pushed off the wall. I don't see how the credibility, the leadership of the United States, the credibility of the United States as a kind of a guarantor of international law, rule of law. I don't see, even when Trump is out, I don't see how that is going to be very easily restored.
Yeah, I'll just make two comments on this. And again, things that, you know, you might not see or hear, but, you know, there is a strange isolationist tendency within the Republican Party that thinks that U.S. foreign policy should be focused on the Western Hemisphere. I mean, you saw this in the 30s, and it's sort of resurgent. You know, we shouldn't be in Europe. We shouldn't be in Asia even. You know, we should sort of retreat to, you know, a kind of fortress America, but fortress Americas. And, you know, we should emphasize our relations with, you know, neighbors. And, you know, that's the Greenland, that's the Panama Canal, that's, you know, managing the hemisphere as a sort of, and retreating to the moat. And I don't think that's a dominant view within the party, because there's still, you know, significant elements that reach far beyond the Western Hemisphere. But that's not a joke. There is this, you know, idea that we should focus our attention in the Western Hemisphere. But just to add some footnotes to what Bob said, I mean, there are two conflicting views of the whole tariff story. You know, one is that he really does want the tariffs to generate revenue and protection. But the other, which I think is emerging as the dominant Besant view, is that the purpose of the tariffs is essentially to negotiate them away. And that what the administration is doing is it's using this initial threat of these very high level of tariffs and then putting a pause on them to force negotiations, which are going to result in a bunch of benefits for the United States. And there, I think it reflects a view of the Trump administration that the United States has excess power, which it has not utilized to its full extent. And that what we should be doing is using the power of the American market to extract these kinds of concessions from our trading partners. And you know, I think that the Trump administration is going to have some success in that, but it's not going to bring back manufacturing jobs, and it's not going to lower the American deficit, because the deficit isn't driven by trade policy, it's driven by macroeconomic policy. I mean, as long as the United States is borrowing as much as it is from the rest of the world, it's going to run corresponding trade deficits.
Yeah.
And so all you're doing is pushing the trade deficit around from one country to another country, but it's still going to be there with someone unless you shut down trade entirely, which is obviously not desirable.
So as we think about the sort of, you know, erosion of democracy over the last decade worldwide, and it seems to be growing, and ways in which autocrats have emboldened each other, and, you know, terms like fake news and stolen elections sort of spread around, with Trump's presidency and his overreach, do you see it worsening this global trend, or with examples like the recent Australian election and Canadian election, is he so extreme that it could prompt a bit of a resurgence or rethinking values, you know, when he's so transactional and doing things in such a non-humane way? I mean, that's a very broad question, but I'm curious about your thoughts.
I think there has been a reaction, not only in Canada and Australia, but also in Europe and other parts of the world. But I think counter to that is the fact that the kind of transactional approach that non-rule of law approach that he's used is also given extra wind at the back of autocrats. Would love to make a deal with Russia. I think we'll make a deal with China at some point. He's given free rein to Netanyahu and the Middle East. So that, to some extent, runs counter to the idea that, well, we'll all wake up someday and become, love democracy again. I think in general, you know, what he wants to do and what his image of the world is to go back to a kind of a spheres of influence policy where, you know, not only the United States dominates the Western Hemisphere, but the China dominates Asia, Russia dominates Europe and Europe. So I'm not very optimistic. I think the egg has been shattered. I think there will be efforts to rebuild, but I think it's a very steep uphill climb to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm watching one piece of this in particular, which is I'm really interested in international institutions and you know, the American withdrawal from them at one level is just going to reduce American influence in those institutions. I mean, that seemed to me to be self-evident. But on the other hand, it's not clear that those institutions necessarily go away. So let's just take a concrete example from trade, the WTO. I mean, the fact that the United States has violated its commitments under the WTO doesn't mean that other countries in the international trading system are going to follow suit. They're going to continue to trade with one another without the 10% tariff that the United States is going to level if that's kept on. And so I think it's just a very difficult picture to read because on the one hand, U.S. power's influence is reduced. That's an advantage for the Chinese and the Russians and other autocratic states to push their counter narratives. But on the other hand, the other advanced industrial states are going to be living inside those institutions and trying to make them function. Yeah. And it's just that the United States is not going to be there as a key player. So to me, this is just another example of own goals or self-defeating behavior.
So we're almost at the point of wrapping up here, but you've got another, 535 days until the midterms. How much chaos do you think can be created between now and then? And hopefully there will then be some real checks and balances and maybe discussions of impeachment under Article 25.
You asked earlier, what should the opposition do? What should the Democrats do? I think that the elections, the congressional elections coming up are really critical decision points. And if the Democrats can recapture at least one of the houses of Congress, that really is going to be a major change in the political landscape and in the sort of the balance of power within the government. So whatever appeals the Democrats make, whether it's to the left or the center, I think that the key question is pouring resources in it and effort and finances into preparing the party for the congressional elections. And that means raising money, finding candidates, suitable candidates that may have different appeals in different parts of the country. You know, moderate in some parts, more progressive in others. And really keeping the eye on that ball. The other side of that is, I think you're going to, in terms of what we can expect going forward, is I think you're going to see more instability and erratic behavior on the part of the Trump administration. I think, I don't know which way it will go, but I think the key point is that it will zig and zag and behave in utterly erratic ways. And finally, going back to an earlier point, I worry about the level of violence and intimidation an escalation of that.
Well, let me try to end on a hopeful note. You know, I'm wondering whether the first 100 days phase of the Trump administration isn't already starting to unravel. And by that, I mean, the market reactions are coming in. They're almost uniformly negative to one of the president's signature moves. They're certainly hostile to reduction of the independence of the Federal Reserve, which, you know, is something he's toyed around with. The court rulings are coming in near unanimous, not fully against the president. There could be some wins with respect to executive powers on the foreign policy front, but that doesn't seem to be going well. Poll numbers are going down. And quietly, I mean, you know, the news is covering this, you know, Republicans in the House and Senate are starting to fret more publicly about the effects of some of the actions which are being undertaken. Now, that doesn't mean that the Trump administration is responsive to all those checks, but it does mean that there's a heavier price that will be paid ultimately by the Republican Party to the extent that Trump continues down the path he's on. And that just opens up opportunities, not only at the federal level, But at the state and local level, for Democrats to come rushing in, and in the last couple of days, there have just been really interesting reports from local elections in states like Texas, where down to the school board level, you're seeing, you know, hawkish and more conservative members of those bodies being thrown out. So maybe we're already in the midst of a correction.
On behalf of Toad, I'd just like to thank you both again, both for your past research in this area, but also for your realism and optimism and a desire to make sure that this is a blip and an aberration in both American and global history. So thank you both very much indeed.